Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop. For this Monday, December 23rd, I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from New Life Chiropractic, Pittsfield, Mass. Dr. Lene Geyer, working to provide evidence-based treatments designed to decrease pain, restore function, and improve quality of life. New-life-chiro.com. Joining us for Medical Monday is Dr. Benjamin Margolis of Albany Med. He is here to discuss gynecological oncology. Be sure to get your calls in early at 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can email your questions as well, voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Benjamin Margolis, gynecological surgery today on Medical Monday. We'll meet Dr. Margolis. Take your phone calls coming up on Vox Pop Medical Monday right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Medical Monday, and with us today is Dr. Benjamin Margolis of Albany Med. Dr. Margolis is a gynecological oncologist who specializes in the medical and surgical management of ovarian, uterine, cervical, and other gynecological cancers. He also treats patients of all ages with pre-invasive conditions and complex gynecologic diseases that require surgery. He completed a fellowship in gynecologic oncology at New York University, Langone Health, and a residency in obstetrics and gynecology at New York Presbyterian, Columbia, both in New York City. He earned his medical degree from Yale. To be part of the conversation today, give us a call at 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551, or email us, voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Benjamin Margolis, welcome back. How are you?
Great. Happy to be here. Thank you for having me again.
There was a funny article several weeks ago in the New York Times, paraphrasing here, but it said, so you've had a hysterectomy. What did the doctor leave behind? What kind of a headline is that? And why? I mean, that's a joke, right?
So, you know, we see people very commonly who've either had a hysterectomy, know someone who have had a hysterectomy, or are gearing up for one themselves. They're one of the most common surgical procedures for women in the United States. And it's astounding how the common vernacular around hysterectomies kind of evolves with time and includes certain language that can be a little bit confusing.
Right. Well, give me an example. I'm not a candidate, so just to explain.
Yeah, so we often talk about the concept of a total hysterectomy, right, or a complete hysterectomy. And when I hear people talk about hysterectomy, oftentimes people use that word total or complete hysterectomy to refer to removal of the ovaries and the fallopian tubes along with the uterus and cervix. So if we kind of take a bird's eye view and we think about all of the gynecologic pelvic structures, right? There's the uterus, the bottom part of the uterus is the cervix that's connected to the vagina, and then the top of the uterus kind of is connected to the fallopian tubes and the ovaries.
Mm-hmm.
So in medical terminology, the term total hysterectomy really refers to removing the entire organ of the uterus, which means removing the uterus and the cervix together. Even though commonly people will say, I've had a total hysterectomy to include or to mean removal of the ovaries and the fallopian tubes. So there's this a little bit of a disconnect, and there's a clarification that's needed, you know, when you're talking to your medical provider or to your surgeon about what exactly you're planning, or if that's happened already, what was done.
I mean, why would you not know before you go under the knife?
Well, that's a good question. I think ideally you want to have, you know, a good informed consent process. You want to have good clarification with your physician. But for one reason or another, it is not that common for people to come to my office or in just common conversation to not really know the details of what was done. You know, I certainly undergo an informed consent and talk about the details with people. But it's more common than you would think that people don't have all the details.
Is that because it is such a traumatic and life-changing event in a patient's life that they're basically just freaked out about it?
I think that a lot of it has to do with location and time. I think historically, people or physicians maybe said, you need a hysterectomy, don't worry about it. And things just kind of happened, you know, without the sort of detail that really should be given in the exam room to explaining the details of a procedure. I think now we all hopefully do a lot better of a job with that. But this recent article kind of shed light on the fact, you know, it talked about a 45-year-old, very well-educated woman who, you know, realized afterwards that she didn't realize her ovaries had been removed, and then coming to terms with, you know, the details of why that had been done. And it was an interesting article.
We're joined today by Dr. Benjamin Margolis of Albany Med. Dr. Margolis is a gynecological oncologist, and our number here is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. With regard to any of the surgeries you do, you know, we'll talk hysterectomies at the moment. Have the techniques changed? We hear so much about minimally invasive surgery. Is that a thing in what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's three ways you can accomplish a hysterectomy. One is with a large incision in the abdomen, and that's called an open technique. Another one is without any incisions on the abdominal wall, and that's called a vaginal hysterectomy. And then there's a technique with small incisions called a laparoscopic hysterectomy. And the laparoscopic version can either be done with the use of robotic surgery, which has gained a lot of traction in the last, say, 20 years since it was introduced. But there's a version of laparoscopic surgery that does not use the robot, and that's just called regular laparoscopy.
How do you make the decision with your patient which of these forms of surgery you're going to use?
Yeah, most of my hysterectomies I try to do minimally invasively, and I use the robotic platform for most of my hysterectomies. If a uterus is very large, if we're concerned about a cancer that's spread around the abdomen, sometimes that requires an open technique. And according to our national guidelines, we actually should be trying to do most hysterectomies, if possible, when not for cancer, vaginally, because they have a very quick recovery time and they don't leave any abdominal incisions. But due to some details about how residents are trained these days, a lot of folks don't get the same exposure to vaginal hysterectomy as they used to. And so my personal practice, I do not feel comfortable doing vaginal hysterectomies myself, just because of the way that I was trained. And so if I have a patient that needs that, I would refer to another provider who is more comfortable with that.
Why do you think that residents are no longer being trained as often in this technique?
Yeah, a lot of this also has to do with history. So years and years ago, we had much less options to offer people that had fibroids, abnormal bleeding, and hysterectomy was really the go-to choice for many gynecologic conditions. And so the amount of total number of hysterectomies in the United States, while it's still one of the most commonly performed procedures, has gone down dramatically because of hormonal forms of birth control that we now use for abnormal bleeding, because of IUDs, which we now use for control of heavy bleeding. And we kind of have a number of really effective therapies. And so the total number is going down, which means that only the people with the most complicated, more complicated situations will undergo a hysterectomy.
What portion or percentage roughly are done laparoscopically these days?
Well, that's a good question. If at all possible, I think we should try to do minimally invasive laparoscopic surgery. I don't know if I know the answer to what proportion, but I would say greater than 50%.
So you know, more than the old-fashioned full cut.
Absolutely. I think the vast majority of hysterectomies these days are done with minimally invasive techniques.
And how long is a patient generally in the hospital afterwards?
I send most of my patients home the same day.
Wow.
Yeah, and there's good evidence to say that it's safe to send home patients who've had a hysterectomy the same day of surgery. You know, sometimes for one reason or another, if someone is medically complicated or it's a longer surgery at the end of the day, they stay one night. For minimally invasive surgery, it's very rare to stay more than one night in the hospital.
Truly amazing. We are joined today by Dr. Benjamin Margolis of Albany Med. He's a gynecologic oncologist and a surgeon, and we will get to your calls momentarily. The number here is 800-348-2551 if you have a question for Dr. Margolis, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. We'll get to the phones in a moment. Cyrus Chestnut there doing that beautiful Vince Guaraldi Christmas stuff here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday. And Dr. Benjamin Margolis joins us from Albany Med. And let's jump right to the phones. We'll go to Debbie in Niskayuna. Hello, Debbie.
Hello.
You're on.
Okay, so I'm 58. There's a history of endometrial cancer in my family. My mother actually died from it. I am having the same symptoms at the same time that my mom got her symptoms. 6 months ago, my doctor was, oh my goodness, this is very concerning. We need to figure out what's going on. No testing between then and now. Now she's saying, well, you know, it's kind of within the realm of normal. I don't think we should be too worried about it. From what I'm thinking of, it's definitely not normal. I want to just jump to having a prophylactic hysterectomy. She wants to do like a D&C and see what's going on. I don't understand what to do when what I want, which is a prophylactic hysterectomy, my doctor refuses to do and instead is kind of dragging her feet and doing testing, which I know is correct, but I'm just saying let's just jump right to the end.
Well, I mean, doctor, you handle this, but I mean, there's a certain, I would say, ethical question involved in going too early, leaping to that, right?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I think the most important thing to do before planning a hysterectomy is establish a diagnosis. So I always make sure that going into a hysterectomy, I know exactly what we're treating. And the reason that's so important is because if there was a cancer there, and again, I don't know the details of your symptoms. Certainly, if there was bleeding after menopause, that's a really important thing to work up and sample, especially with your family history. If there was a cancer there, the type of hysterectomy and the person doing the hysterectomy would be different. So if you had a preoperative diagnosis of endometrial cancer, you'd want a gynecologic oncologist doing the surgery. We would talk about looking at the lymph nodes and assessing if cancer spread anywhere. And if your doctor did the hysterectomy and then found out that there was a cancer there afterwards, that's not the best situation. It's one that we can work with. And, you know, sometimes we need to go back and then look at those lymph nodes to see if there's any cancer that's moved to that area.
Oh, my goodness. I didn't even know that. That makes sense then why she's doing what she's doing. Okay, that answered my question. Thank you very much.
I always favor sampling before jumping to a hysterectomy if there's any suspicion for cancer.
Debbie, thanks for the call. Number here is 800-348-2551. What is endometrial cancer?
Yeah, so there's different parts of the uterus that can get cancer. One of them is the inner lining of the uterus, which is called the endometrium. That's kind of where the monthly period comes from. And so endometrial cancer is a cancer of the lining, glandular lining of the inside of the uterus. There's a different type of uterine cancer called sarcoma, and that can arise from the muscle, the wall of the uterus.
If you go in for a hysterectomy, what's the recovery time? I mean, you said you're out of the building, the hospital, most times the same day. But I assume you have bed rest and everything else for some time.
Definitely not bed rest, actually.
Really?
Yeah. The recovery time is tricky to talk about because it's really different for everyone. I actually encourage my patients to be up and walking around the day of surgery and afterwards and to start increasing their activity day by day. We do say, as a general rule, that we put restrictions on heavy lifting greater than 10 pounds. And those, you know, those are evolving with time. We usually say for at least 2 to 4 weeks. People often have questions about bathing, showering, return to work, and things are quite individualized depending on what work you do. I'd say most people, I say you get about your daily life at home, getting up from bed, going to the bathroom, getting yourself something to eat or drink, walking upstairs. That's day of surgery and keeps getting better and better. And it's really the things like driving, harder physical activity with a physically demanding job and heavy lifting. Those things can be somewhere on the 4 to 6 week range.
Why the heavy lifting? I had abdominal surgery decades ago. Mm-hmm. I had a burst appendix, mm-hmm. and they said, oh, you can't lift anything that heavier than a pack of cards for X number of days or weeks. Why? Why?
We're a little more lenient in the gynecology world. We say a gallon of milk. So one reason is because of incisional hernias. So when you make an incision in the abdominal wall, you kind of weaken the abdominal wall. And if you're putting a lot of pressure on the wall of the abdomen, you can develop a hernia. With minimally invasive techniques, that's not as common. But the bigger reason is because the biggest incision, at least with a minimally invasive hysterectomy, is at the top of the vagina. After we disconnect the uterus and cervix, we sew that up. So that incision, if it's exposed to a lot of pressure, could break open. And that's a very emergent situation that could require urgent surgery, a visit to the emergency room. It's very uncommon, maybe on the order of 1% or so.
Dr. Benjamin Margolis of Albany Med is our guest on this edition of Medical Monday. Is there significant post-op pain for the patient?
I think post-op discomfort is something that you want to educate people on preoperatively. We try to do that. We have a team at Albany Med called the Enhanced Recovery After Surgery, and they also call people and educate on post-op recovery. Surgery is always going to come with some level of discomfort. In the past, and practices around prescribing different pain medications are very different. I send home all of my hysterectomies that are minimally invasive with Tylenol and an extra strength version of ibuprofen, and I don't routinely prescribe opioids. Some people do, but I find that most of my patients don't need stronger pain medications, but they are available with a quick call if people end up needing them.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551 if you have a question for Dr. Benjamin Margolis, or you could email us at voxpop@wamc.org, and we'll get right back to the phones. But a couple of emails here. This one's from Jill in Mountainville, New York. Jill writes, 18 years ago, at age 55, I underwent an LAVH/BSO, which you'll have to tell me what it is, and was diagnosed with stage 1A endometrial carcinoma. I've heard since that there are some residual risks with vaginal hysterectomies. Should I still be under surveillance for recurrence? And that's from Jill in Mountainville.
Yeah, I think once you have a history of endometrial cancer, it's always a good idea to see a gynecologist yearly. I think 10 years later, the chance of a recurrence for a stage 1A endometrial cancer is very low. Probably don't need to be seeing a gynecologic oncologist, but I absolutely think that someone taking a look at the top of the vagina once a year is a great thing to do for anyone who's had a history of endometrial cancer, no matter what stage.
All right, this one's from Julia. I got a hormonal IUD to help with my heavy and abnormal periods in August. My latest blood work panel came back with low platelets. Is there a chance that they are related?
I do not think so. There's no relation that I know with the hormones in an IUD, which is called progesterone, and causing low platelets. I'm not a hematology expert, and maybe there's some rare things out there, but does not seem related to me.
We're joined by Dr. Benjamin Margolis of Albany Med. The number here is 800-348-2551. We'll go to Copake. And Franny, you're on.
Hi there. Yeah, about 20 years ago, I went for a routine D&C for postmenopausal bleeding, and the doctor accidentally perforated my bowel and uterus and fallopian tube and ovary. So needless to say, I was very septic. I almost died, but there was a good surgeon in the hospital who was able to perform a colostomy, and I'm fine today, and it was closed. I'm just wondering how common that is, because that was quite an event.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that story. When we talk about any surgical procedure, we talk about, all the risks. That's part of the informed consent process. For D&C, one of which is dilation and curettage, getting a sample from the inside of the uterus, we do talk about perforation.
I wasn't told that a bowel perforation was a risk,
I hear you on that. We do talk about the risk of perforation, and what I was just about to say is that we usually talk about the risk of a uterine perforation, accidentally poking the instruments through the wall of the uterus. And, I talk about that with a D&C as a possibility. I have to say, a bowel perforation that's unrecognized at the time is very rare. You know, our safeguard for perforation is that if you perforate the uterus with, you know, kind of a what we call a blunt instrument, something that's not sharp, and you're not suspicious that you've hurt anything on the inside, most of the time it is safe to abort the procedure and that will heal on its own. If you perforate the uterus with something that's sharp and you realize that you might have been kind of scraping and could cause damage to surrounding organs inside the belly, then the right thing to do at that point, if you realize it, is to look with a camera inside the belly button and do something called a laparoscopy. So, you know, is it possible at that time?
She said that she didn't have a camera,
right,
but she thought she felt something squishy. And, well, actually, she sent it for a biopsy and it came back bowel. So, I mean, it was detected at the time, but by that time, there was fortunately a good surgeon in the hospital.
And I think
I didn't wake up.
That's a key.
Yeah, when I woke up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let the doc talk now.
Oh, no, I think identifying I think it's good that that was identified at the time of surgery. So similarly, like when I talk to people about the complications that can happen with surgery, identifying an injury at the time of the surgery is always preferred to, you know, a delayed diagnosis. So I do think that perforations are something that happen not that infrequently with a DNC. I mean, they're not common. And I put it maybe at a 1% risk. But I think the fact that your doctor recognized it, called in the right person, and then you had the right, you know, kind of fix to the surgery at the same time is ultimately the responsible and good thing to do.
Franny, thanks for the call. Now, does robotic surgery make those chances better?
Robotic surgery improves your dexterity on the inside. For me personally, it allows me to do more complicated surgeries with more ease and, you know, more skill than I would have if I didn't have the robot. You know, the robot comes with its own risks. You know, sometimes when you're putting the instruments in and out of the abdomen, if you're not careful and you're not looking, you know, those instruments can brush by other structures, and that's one way you can get an injury, just like you had mentioned. So we do our best to be as careful as possible.
Dr. Benjamin Margolis of Albany Med is our guest today. The number is 800-348-2551, and the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll get back to the emails shortly. But we'll go to Joseph in Athol, Massachusetts. Joseph, you're on.
Oh, thank you. I'd like to bring the doctor back to something he was discussing earlier, which is the third possible type of hysterectomy through the vagina. And I'm wondering, is it, not to put too fine a point on it, but is this a sexist thing? Is it that we've spent many decades not listening to women talk about their insides? And your own comment about how women sometimes don't know what's to be done or even what was done to them. And I'm wondering, is there a little bit of a holdover of trust us, we're the doctors, you're women? I'm just curious, because it sounds a little like that, to be honest.
I mean, I can't think of a corollary for men where they go into surgery and don't really know what happened, right? I mean, I think, yeah, there's a lot of... It's a complicated, complex topic, you know, and I do think that there is historical reality in the fact that, you know, you look at things that have happened in this country, right? People have been sterilized without knowing it. You know, there's a darker history towards gynecology, and so I certainly won't be the one to deny that, you know, there could be some truth there.
All right, Joseph, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. In general, when I go to the doctor, maybe I'm old school. When I go to the doctor, doctor says, you need this. I say, okay. Obviously, the doctor has more training than I do, even though I do have the internet. I mean, there is that. By the way, does that drive you nuts as a doc? The fact that there is a vast quantity of somewhat okay information out there?
Yeah, I generally encourage my patients to do the research they want if it's going to be helpful for them, if it's going to make them feel like they're a part of the process and come to me with questions. You know, I certainly try to gear them towards trusted sites and give, you know, patient information pamphlets that are approved by our national societies. You know, sometimes people find things out there that I question. And, you know, there is a lot of complementary and alternative medicine, and most of it, as long as I feel like it's not detrimental to what the patient has going on and our treatment plan, I'm very open to it, and we do a lot of things alongside. And some patients decide to kind of abandon what we call standard of care, you know, medical advice to do alternative treatments, and ultimately, that's their decision, and, you know, it's their path, and that's okay.
But if you know it's not going to be as successful in your heart of hearts, is there not an ethical quandary there?
You know, I give people my best medical opinion, but then ultimately, I think that it's hard to fault anyone for doing the thing that they believe in. So I have definitely seen patients do things that I, in my heart of hearts, don't feel like are going to be that successful. I have other patients who surprise me. I have patients who've got some stable disease, you know, doing 4-day water fasts, and I kind of give them a round of applause.
All right. This email, we'll get back to the phones in a moment, 800-348-2551. This email from Lisa. A couple months ago, I had a pelvic ultrasound. There was a 3 centimeter uterine fibroid noted. What steps would you take next to explore that?
It really depends on why you had the ultrasound. So, you know, the practice of doing a yearly ultrasound just to sort of check things out is something that a lot of gynecologists do. And, you know, there's probably an hour-long discussion we can have about whether or not we should do that. If it was for symptoms, if it was because there was pain or bleeding, then you want to talk to your doctor, your OBGYN, about, you know, the different treatment modalities that there are for fibroids. And there are many, you know, in terms of hormonal treatments, surgical treatments, ways to shrink fibroids. If it's what we call an incidental finding, you know, the ultrasound was done for another reason or it was done just for routine check, then a 3-centimeter fibroid to me is a benign finding that doesn't really require any follow-up as long as it's asymptomatic.
We're joined by Dr. Benjamin Margolis today from Albany Medical Center. The number is 800-348-2551. And we'll grab a call or two before the next break, and then we'll go back to the email bag, et cetera, et cetera. Jill is in Waterford. Hello, Jill.
Hello.
Hello, you're on.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. Nice to. Happy holidays to you, my friend.
Oh, yes, to you too. So I want to piggyback on a caller who wanted to know why she had to go through so many tests before jumping straight to whatever the surgery was. I have a same similar question, except in my situation, there was a diagnosis, but I had to put up with, let's try this, let's try this, let's try this, for 30 years. Before I was allowed to get a hysterectomy. And I have been fabulous ever since. But why waste all that time and money? And I was driving my mother crazy.
Yeah.
And I wanted the hysterectomy, but they said they couldn't do it because I might change my mind and want kids. I said, where do I sign to say that I don't?
Yeah. We get a lot into, you know, sort of medical paternalism with that question, and I think it is a good one. You know, there are some studies out there that show that people who are quite young, you know, in their 20s and 30s that have hysterectomy, you know, a certain portion of patients will end up regretting their decision. I personally really trust people when they tell me that their plans are that they don't want, you know, future fertility. And if there's a medical indication for a hysterectomy,
hello?
Like...
Oh, you're not hearing this, Jill?
No, I can't hear him at all.
All right, come a little closer, yeah. Doc.
If there's a medical indication for a hysterectomy, like abnormal bleeding, fibroids, pain...
Yep.
you know, there's many of them out there.
Abnormal bleeding and pain.
Yeah. And I tend to trust, you know, and believe when people say that they don't want fertility. I someone was very young, you know, I might give them one line to say, you know, that fact that certain people might end up regretting their decision, you know, by doing a hysterectomy. But in general, I think the person sitting in front of you is the best person, you know, who knows their body and their intentions. And I think it's very reasonable to proceed with a hysterectomy for someone who's got a medical indication without kind of, you know, putting them through too much, you know, before you get there, if it's a reasonable treatment for the problem, which it seems like
right.
it was.
Right, and that's what I wanted to do. But every doctor I saw before I turned in my, I was in my late 40s before I, they let me do it.
Yeah.
And that's because they exhausted everything else.
Yeah, I tend to offer, you know, I lay out the menu of different things that can be tried. And if someone's done with fertility and strongly desires a hysterectomy, it is definitive management for many gynecologic issues. And it's a reasonable thing to consider a lot of the time.
Jill, thanks for the call. We'll take a break here. 800-348-2551 is the number. Dr. Benjamin Margolis joins us from Albany Med. 800-348-2551. And we'll check the email bag as well, voxpop@wamc.org. Now, there are millions of terrible Christmas records out there, and there are also some good ones, and that's a good one. Vince Guaraldi from the Charlie Brown Christmas soundtrack. 800-348-2551 is the number. Dr. Benjamin Margolis of Albany Med joins us on this edition of Medical Monday. Let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
With all the cesarean sections done these days, are there many episiotomies done anymore?
You know, that's a practice that was more common in the past and does have a role from time to time. But and it's been a while since I've done obstetrics, so this is not part of my day-to-day life. But we try to avoid episiotomies if possible. It's a little bit, you know, can be tricky to repair. They can lead to some larger tearing, even though they're sometimes used to try to prevent that. And there's some evidence that they can lead to painful intercourse afterwards.
Jim, it's none of my business, obviously, but why are you interested?
What? I can't hear very good.
That's all right, man. Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. Dr. Benjamin Margolis joins us. Let's do a couple emails. voxpop@wamc.org. This is from Barb in Schenectady. Due to BRCA1 diagnosis, I had prophylactic total hysterectomy and ovaries and tubes removed. Also had prolapse repaired during surgery. Apparently the prolapse repair didn't work because I need to wear a pad all the time due to urinary accidents. Worse than before the surgery. Could this also be due to the empty space I now have since all female organs were removed? Suggestions. Not another surgery, please. That's from Barb.
Yeah, so prolapse is a common issue that we face, you know, in aging populations, and repairing it at the time of hysterectomy is an important thing to do. Sometimes when you repair prolapse, you can actually unmask some urinary incontinence issues. And so it's possible that by repairing the prolapse and straightening out the urethra, that kind of brought to light an issue that was not so prominent beforehand. There are definitely things that can be done for this. I would encourage you to follow up with a subspecialist called a urogynecologist. They specialize in female gynecology and urology symptoms. There are fixes such as pelvic floor physical therapy to strengthen the muscles of the pessary floor. There's something called a pessary that can be put in. It's a plastic ring that goes inside the vagina, puts a little bit of pressure on the urethra and helps keep it closed. And I know you said no to surgeries, but the most effective thing if this is found to be stress incontinence is actually something called a sling, which is a small piece of mesh that places a little bit of pressure on the urethra, helps keep the urine inside.
All right, let's see. Carol writes in, says, when is preventive hysterectomy recommended for ovarian cancer? Sister died from ovarian cancer.
grandmother died from cervical or some other gynecological cancer. At 65, is it too late? Have had CT negative but unsuccessful vaginal ultrasound to screen.
Yeah, the tricky thing about ovarian cancer is that there really is no good screening methodology. So some people, we've been trying for a very long time to detect ovarian cancer early and to screen people who are asymptomatic, but there's not been any very compelling data that has made it to the mainstream population. You know, a sister who's had ovarian cancer is concerning, and I think that's something to bring up to your doctor. It's important to know if that sister had genetic testing, if they had the BRCA1 or 2 gene or a different one. And that's something that if your sister's available for testing, that's something that could be considered. If your sister's not available for testing, then just based on having a sister, a first-degree relative with ovarian cancer, that probably is an indication for you to get some genetic testing and see if you carry any mutations that increase your risk. If you don't, I would not recommend any sort of preventative surgery for ovarian cancer.
Number to call here, by the way, is 800-348-2551. If you have a question for Dr. Benjamin Margolis of Albany Med, you can, of course, email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Ben in Matamoros writes in, do all patients with ovarian teratoma also have NMDA encephalitis, or do some people with ovarian teratoma not develop this condition? How common is the association? I have no idea what I just read. Maybe you can give me some definitions.
So, yeah, a teratoma is a benign ovarian tumor, also known as a dermoid tumor. It commonly impacts people early, well, across the age spectrum, but is the typical ovarian tumor that you'll see like teeth and hair growing into. It kind of has representation from all three of the germ lines, so you can see different tissues from different areas in the body growing inside an ovarian mass, but usually they are benign. There is a very, very rare syndrome, which is that NMDA receptor encephalitis, which is a neurologic disorder where you become disoriented and altered and actually can fall into a coma due to the presence of the teratoma, and they think it has to do with some of the chemicals that teratoma secretes, and actually by removing it, you cure someone of that. That's extremely rare. So teratoma is quite common. The NMDA receptor encephalitis that goes along with it is extremely, extremely rare.
Dr. Benjamin Margolis joins us. Email is voxpop@wamc.org, and the number is 800-348-2551. Anonymous in West Hurley, can you talk about what is available to screen for uterine cancer? Seems like women suddenly find out they have it when it's too late. It's scary. And that's from Anonymous in West Hurley.
Yeah. So depending on your personal risk, you know, if you have a strong family history of uterine cancer or particularly of colon cancer, that's something to tell your doctor about. Sometimes that can lead to genetic testing that picks up mutations that put you at increased risk for uterine cancer. And in those situations, you might be able to do a preventative hysterectomy or screen with biopsies. For the general population, there really is no screening that's proven to be effective, and the majority of uterine cancers are actually diagnosed at an early stage. And the beneficial thing about them is that they have an early warning symptom. So anyone who presents with bleeding after menopause, that's cause for concern, and that requires imaging or possibly a biopsy. And so the reason that more uterine cancers are found in the early stage is because there's an outflow from the endometrium down through the cervix and to the vagina. And most people, and I would hope that we can educate folks that any bleeding after menopause is not normal and requires a call to the doctor.
Dr. Benjamin Margolis joins us. 800-348-2551 is our number. What is the most common type of gynecologic cancer that you deal with? And also, what's the most mysterious to you or to the medical profession?
The most common type of gynecologic cancer is actually uterine cancer. And the incidence, the amount of people that are getting diagnosed with uterine cancer, is actually growing year by year. We think the reason has to do with obesity, because extra fat on the body helps increase the levels of estrogen, and higher levels of estrogen in the body are associated with the development of endometrial cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the most common. And then there's a bunch of rare gynecologic malignancies out there. Certainly something that I think we don't see very often, and something that has very specialized centers in the United States, is something called gestational trophoblastic neoplasia, which is a mouthful, but it's sort of a cancer that involves pregnancy-related tissues and originates sometimes from the placenta. So there's very specialized centers in the United States that are real experts at treating that type of cancer. All gynecologic oncologists can treat that cancer, but for the more complicated cases, we often rely on the advice of experts in the field.
Number here is 800-348-2551. If you have a question for Dr. Benjamin Margolis, 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Not speaking about you personally, but taking perspective of the whole of the medical industry and the whole profession that does what you do, what can you guys do better?
Well, that's a great question. I think far from it. I think there's always really good opportunities for improvement in terms of like handling everything that a patient is going through. So I think we do a fairly good job at breaking down the medical problems, at offering people what treatment options are available, at going through surgeries and administering chemotherapy. But what I would love us to do a little bit more of, and I'm talking to myself as well, is find that extra moment to try to figure out like what's going on in people's lives, why is the journey that they're on really difficult, what's the reason that someone maybe didn't take their medications. And those are tricky because, you know, visits are short and time is limited and our days are inevitably a little bit rushed. And so that balance of how to treat the whole patient, treat people with the kind of like time and respect that they deserve, but also get through your whole day is something that I think a lot of doctors struggle with. And we could always do better.
So we need more doctors, basically.
Yeah, I don't think we need, you know, if people need that eighth day in the week, I think we need like another hour of our day to kind of, you know, handle all these little things that are super duper important, but can fall by the wayside when you're trying to get through the clinical visit.
I'm going to mark that down as a good answer. Dr. Benjamin Margolis joins us from Albany Med. This email from Christy. A couple weeks ago, I had a sharp pain in my right ovary area. It was on and off for a few hours, then it went away. Any ideas what it might have been? It's tough to do.
Do we know
over
how
the
old
air.
Christy is?
No,
it's hard. I think if you have symptoms like that that are persistent, that come back, you know, time after time, it's a good reason to call the gynecologist. I would certainly consider ordering an ultrasound to see if there could be a cyst there.
Even a one shot, couple hours, and then it's gone for good?
No, I would say if it's a one-time thing, I give most people a pass, you know, if something happens once and doesn't come back. I don't know, I kind of talk to people about symptoms of life. You know, sometimes you just have a little something that comes and goes. I know I have. I don't work everything up like that. But I think symptoms that are progressive and getting worse or symptoms that are persistent over the course of a couple of weeks require attention.
Let's go back to the phones with Dr. Benjamin Margolis, 800-348-2551. Beth is in New Paltz. Hello, Beth.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I was wondering if there had been any new research on hot flashes and night sweats following menopause. I've 15 years in, and I still get a dozen or so a day. And my gynecologist just says, live with it. They'll go away.
Yeah, I think hot flashes that don't go away with time and that are very bothersome deserve attention. And I think being kind of more strongly worded with the fact that you want something done about them is reasonable from your end. So I think, you know, there are many different treatment options for menopausal hot flashes. Some of the most effective treatments are actually hormonal treatments, giving back some of the hormones that decline with age and with menopause. Some people don't like that idea, even though a lot of hormonal treatments are very safe. They get a bad rap from a study that was done a long time ago. But there's also non-hormonal treatment options. Very recently, if you've seen, there's some commercials about newer treatment options that target the temperature regulating centers in the brain. So there's a lot on the table for hot flash management.
Beth.
Okay, so I will bring that up with her. Thank you for taking the call.
I think being persistent is a good idea. When something's really bothering you, sometimes you got to just kind of make the point, you know, that this is a big deal for you.
So what you were talking about, the study years ago, this is hormones replacement, basically, right? And it did get a bad rap. What's our current medical thinking on this today?
Yeah, there's something called the Women's Health Initiative, which was a study that looked at a bunch of nurses who took hormonal therapy. And there have been a lot of different interpretations of this data most recently, and with the data looked at, you know, over and over, we believe that giving hormone replacement therapy to people who are average risk after menopause is safe and effective for postmenopausal
for how long?
Hot flashes. The general paradigm is that we give the lowest dose for the shortest period possible. So you want to get people's symptoms under control, you want to get people's quality of life back, and then over the course of years, you know, it's a very individualized decision. Some people really, really cling to their hormonal therapy and don't want to give it up. I'd say people that are past their 50s, you know, approaching, you know, getting into their 60s, you should have a discussion with their doctor about the concept of tapering off of hormone replacement therapy.
At that point, is it just vanity?
No, it's very functional. It's hot flashes, mood
even into
changes.
The 60s.
Well, those are, you know, without that hormonal therapy, if those symptoms come back, they can be really debilitating to people and they can be life altering. Mm. Yeah. So it's certainly not about looks. It's very much about how people feel.
Dr. Benjamin Margolis is our guest. Let's go to Chester, Massachusetts. And Ann, you're on.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi.
Dr. Margolis, this January, it will have been 30 years since I was diagnosed with endometrial cancer. I went to my monthly checkups, and at my fifth month checkup, my gynecologist palpated my vaginal wall. They ended up feeling one. There was one showed up on a scan, additional, and then there was a third one that when she literally checked all my lymph nodes and the omentum, found a third mass. I think the largest was almost 10 centimeters, and obviously a pretty quick period of time. I then went through chemo. I had hormone therapy to make all those bad cells be like red flags to a bull. And I'm very happy to say that I was a good doobie and still go to my gynecologist every year for a checkup. I went to my oncology gynecologist for in excess of 10 years, and now I just go to one of her former students, actually, to a regular. Do I just continue seeing gynecologists for the rest of my life?
Everything that you mentioned in terms of your treatment, that was all 30 years ago?
Yep.
Oh, okay. And so you've been disease-free for 30 years?
As of January,
which
yes.
Is awesome.
That's amazing, yeah. And especially given the picture that you painted.
Amazing.
It sounds, thank you for not swearing. Yeah. I appreciate
hello.
It.
Hello.
Sounds like that was not such an early-stage disease based on what you had mentioned. So
Well, it was 1A.
Ah, okay.
I literally started spotting at the tip of your baby finger between Christmas and New Year's.
Yeah.
And I had just not even a month had my pap, and it was normal.
Yeah.
And I called up the doctor's office, my regular gynecologist, and they said, but you were just here. And I said, something's wrong. Something's wrong.
Amazing, Anne.
We
and
try never to say
I'm
that people
in.
Are cured from their cancers because there's always a chance of late
no,
recurrence.
I
but I think 30 years is two thumbs up, A+,
plus,
and still see the gynecologist once a year.
Still see the gynecologist once a year. Anne, fantastic. Thank you. We're going to end the show that wonderful note, and we appreciate it very much. All right, Dr. Margolis, we have about 20 seconds here. Anything I forgot to mention, which is probably a 3 hours worth?
I think, you know, keeping note of your family history, keeping note of your symptoms, and having good communication with your OBGYN is the most important thing you can do to preserve your health.
Matt, beautiful. Thank you for being here, and happy holidays to you. Appreciate you coming in here, and we'll see you next time. Support comes from Stinging Nettle Apothecary, Main Street, Catskill, New York, offering handcrafted organic herb-based products, incorporating natural herbal remedies into daily life. StingingNettleNY.com. Well, there you have it. Thanks again to Dr. Benjamin Margolis for being here today. Thank you for listening. Terrific calls. Thanks for the emails, everything else. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Happy holidays there, Mr. Zach. I hope you get a nice present there a couple days from now. Ed Rosen, thank you for screening the calls. I'm Ray Graff. All right, no Vox Pop for the next couple of days. I'm on the naughty list. I have to do some lobbying with Santa today and tomorrow. If you celebrate, have a Merry Christmas. If you don't, you know what? Have a merry day all the same. Mary is very good. We'll see you Thursday for physical therapy with Matthew Goodemote. Stand by for something wonderful.